I am Valerie Kaur. My grandfather was Kehar Singh. He was one of the first pioneers to come from India to America. The story goes, he left his village, Chandnama, or New Moon, in northern India, in Punjab.
Okay, wait a second. Sorry, could you start with he left his village? Because someone opened the door.
He left his village called Chandnama, or New Moon, in northern India, in Punjab, in 1911. He was 17 years old, and he followed his older brother to Manila in Shanghai. He worked in Shanghai for 2 years as a night watchman for Shell Oil Company, and then his brother and him decided that they wanted to go to America. So in 1913, they arrived in San Francisco, but the port authorities told them that they could not enter because they did not have the $5 port fee. So they turned my grandfather and his brother all the way back. They went back to Manila and worked for a few more months to earn the money and came back in September 1913, and they entered the country then. They worked as farmers. They made their way down California's coast until they settled in Clovis, which is near Fresno in California's Central Valley.
Oh, that's fine. Did you say this time what the ship was? Didn't you say that before that they came on a...
Yeah.
Tell me what the ship was.
They traveled by steamship from Shanghai to California.
Okay, go ahead. They traveled by steamship.
They traveled by steamship from Shanghai to California. And once they arrived, they worked their way down California and worked on farms. They slept in barns at night. They worked for...
Did you start with they slept in barns? Mm-hmm.
They slept in barns. During the day, they would work on the farms, picking oranges and pruning, working on these farms for pennies an hour. I think the wage was 11 cents an hour, and on good pay was 15 cents an hour, until they finally settled in Clovis near Fresno in California's Central Valley. Sorry.
It's okay.
let's see. Now, the California...
So why don't you start with what they were paid when they were working, when they initially were working?
They were paid 11 cents an hour. And I remember my grandfather was really proud because he had a shirt that cost 12 cents. and good pay was 15 cents an hour. But even then, they had to live on the farms they worked on. At night, they slept in barns. And because there were snakes in the barns, they had to take out the grape trays and sleep on the grape trays to protect themselves.
Could you do that again? Sorry, because you started laughing.
Yeah, sorry.
It's okay.
I was just imagining how funny that was. so start from...
When they would sleep in the barns or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So during the day, they would work on the farms, and at night, they would sleep in the barns. And because there were snakes in the barns, they had to take out the grape trays and sleep on the grape trays to protect themselves. Due to the Asian Exclusion Acts, my grandfather was not allowed to become a citizen. He was not allowed to own land. He was not allowed to leave the country because he would not be allowed back once he returned. So he could not marry an Indian wife. And while many of his peers married into Mexican families, my grandfather was so staunch about marrying a Punjabi woman. So he had to wait until 1946 when the laws were lifted so that he could return to India in 1947 and marry my grandmother. My grandfather was about 55. He had a completely white beard. And my grandmother was about 20. people really discouraged my grandmother from marrying my grandfather. They said that you'll never have children, you'll never have a family. But my grandmother came back to India to show them that she had four children.
So when did you know any of these people who had married Mexicans, and sort of why did they do that? Just maybe go over that a little bit more. Were they still considered part of the communities they were in? Did they have to sort of change their identity?
You know, I don't know if I can comment too much on that.
Okay, no, that's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
It's an interesting...
I have a feeling that my grandfather I knew the families, but kind of lost touch as the generations went on. And so I have their children really fell more into Mexican culture rather than Punjabi culture. But my grandfather thought it was really important to pass on Punjabi culture to his children.
So before your father was born, when he was still there and he was young, he couldn't own land. So what did he do? There was another way you were talking about it. Because he couldn't own land, he.
Because he couldn't own land, he would work for white farm owners. So there was one ranch, Wawona Ranch, that my grandfather really ran the entire farm for decades. And the man who owned it, Wilson, was an attorney who lived somewhere else. And Wilson actually wanted to sell the land to my grandfather, but he couldn't because the laws wouldn't permit that.
So, what kind of relationship did your grandfather have with the people in Clovis?
My grandfather was very loved and respected by people in Clovis. Every time I run into somebody from that generation, they go on and on about what a gentleman my grandfather was. It makes me very proud. They talk about him being very well dressed and polite, very tall man with a beard and turban, very respectful, very trusted in the community. And I think it was like that because everybody knew everybody in Clovis in those days. It was a small farming town with many different immigrant families. There were,
Right, it was a small farming town.
it was a small farming town with many different immigrant families. There were Germans, there were Irish, there were Italians, and my grandfather was friends with all of them. They all supported each other.
And do you mind saying quickly about the importance of his wearing a turban? Because I think there'll be lots of people who are listening to this who don't understand sort of why.
Keeping one's hair long is an article of Sikh faith, and most men and some women keep their long hair in a turban. Now, through history, the turban has been targeted in riots and violence and religious persecution. And so, at that time, the turban represented one's identity as a Punjabi man and as a Sikh. And so when my grandfather came here, even though they were labeled Hindus,
Can you start with even? Sorry, go ahead.
even though they were labeled as Hindus, and even though they were made targets of race riots, my grandfather thought it was very important for him to preserve his identity and his culture, even in this new country. And in fact, he thought that if anywhere, this is the place to preserve difference and to celebrate difference.
So the label, they were labeled Hindus, but that wasn't his religion.
Right.
So, do you mind making that distinction? I know it seems really simple, but it would be nice to have that distinction.
Many of the early Punjabi farmers who came to America were labeled Hindus. They were called Hindus, but they were Sikh. Their turban and beard marked them as Sikh. And Sikhism is a separate religion from Hinduism. I could go on if you
Just a little bit. Go on a little bit.
want. Sikhism is the youngest of the major world religions. There are 23 million Sikhs worldwide and 500,000 Sikhs in the United States. It grew in northern India in the 15th century as a way to respond to the divisions and oppressions within medieval Hinduism and Islam. So it was a bit of a liberation movement, you can say, against the caste system, against forced conversion, against empty ritual. So Guru Nanak, the founder of the faith, it was said that he disappeared by the river for 3 days and emerged with these words on his lips: "There is no Hindu, there is no Muslim," which means beneath all husks and labels, humanity is one. The way that Sikhs show that they are Sikhs in their communities is by keeping these articles of faith, and the most prominent is long hair, which is kept in a turban. That's why my grandfather thought it was so important for him to keep his identity as a Sikh, even in this new country.
Thank you. So, yeah, if you could mention the few things you said about his being a member of the Gaur Party.
My grandfather was a member of the Gadhar Party in California in the 1920s. And the Gadhar Party was an organization of Indian Americans, Indians outside of India, who wanted to support India's freedom from the British Empire. for many years, they mobilized to try to overthrow the British in India, and there was a huge crackdown and a series of assassinations of people in the Gaur party in the United States. And my grandfather feared for his life in those early days, and especially toward the end of his life.
Wait a sec.
Yeah.
It got louder instead of quieter. Go, plane, go. Can you start with my grandfather feared for his life? Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start a little bit earlier. I think
that's fine.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In the 1920s, my grandfather was a member of the Gaur Party in California. And the Gaur movement was an organization of Indians outside of India who wanted to free India from the British Empire. So they had many meetings. A big hub was in Berkeley, California. And my grandfather supported this movement for freedom. When the British Empire found out about this organization, of course, there was a huge crackdown and a series of assassinations to kill the freedom movement. So my grandfather, I remember he feared for his life in those days when there was a crackdown. And even in his later days toward his death, there was always this, when he fell into dementia, there was this fear that his life was under attack. I don't know if that made sense.
And then, I mean, I know these are things before your grandmother came, but mm-hmm. then the stories about the internment and what he did mm-hmm. to his friends, the Japanese.
When World War II started, when Pearl Harbor happened in 1942 and World War II began, there was the Japanese internment. Many Japanese American farmers in Fresno and Clovis were taken off into camps.
Can you start with many Japanese farmers?
Many Japanese American farmers in Clovis were taken off into internment camps. My grandfather was very good friends with these Japanese farmers, and he actually looked over the farms and the property of several families, including the Miramotos. The Takahashis have told me that my grandfather was one of the few people who came all the way to Arizona to visit them in the internment camps. And when my grandfather returned from Arizona, he brought back a petrified rock, and that same petrified rock has been sitting on my fireplace in my family's home for decades. When I look at this rock, it's a symbol to me of real solidarity in times of crisis. And I imagine how my grandfather stood side by side with Japanese Americans during the internment, and how many of these same descendants of Japanese internees are now standing side by side with my community in the post 9/11 backlash.
And then, when could he own land?
In 1946.
Okay, so mm-hmm. maybe he could own land in 1946, and then what did he do?
So as
Okay, go ahead.
As soon as the laws permitted my grandfather to own land, my grandfather bought 40 acres with his brother on Temperance and Bullard. And he grew plums and peaches and strawberries. He lived in an old wooden house. There was no tractor. They still used horses. And my father was actually born on this land, and I was born on this land as well. So this piece of land has been in my family for such a long time.
And is it still there?
It's still there. And the painful part for me is just in the past year, the development in Clovis has expanded to encompass my family's land. So when I go back there, I'm very disoriented because I see these suburbs, these cookie-cutter houses.
Could you say that again?
Yeah.
And hold your bracelets because they're gone. I know it's difficult. Jewelry's very difficult when you're recording.
I'm just going to take a drink.
Oh, sure. So when you go back to Clovis.
So the same land that my grandfather had farmed back in the 1940s has been in my family for all these decades. My father was born on this land. I was born on this land. What's so painful to me is that just in the past year, my family had to sell this land because the development had expanded to encompass our property. So where there once was fields of strawberries, now there are suburbs, cookie cutter houses. And when I look at that, I feel a real sadness because I feel like the site of my family history has now been erased to look like every other part of the United States, a place without history. But then I remember that this land before my grandfather was here was owned by the Yokut Indians, a different kind of Indian. and perhaps this is just what no one really has ownership of land, but it falls into different hands. And what we can do is remember that which is important to us, which is why my family has preserved the old house that my grandfather first lived in. And we're going to turn it into a museum so that my children can learn about my family history.
It's wonderful. And where is the house?
It's now sitting, I should be clear. So my father built his house on my grandfather's original property. So while the rest of the land has been sold to development, my family's house is still there. So we've moved the small house into our backyard, so to speak, to keep this history alive.
That's wonderful. And then your mother came, or your grandmother, pardon me.
Yes. My grandmother, her name is Dilip Kaur, and in 1949, when she met my grandfather, who had gone back to India to get married, she was the only divorced woman in her village in Punjab. And at that point, it was a huge taboo to be a divorced woman in a village in India at that time. People were saying that her life was over. When she saw my grandfather, she saw a ticket to America. And all the people around her told her, you can't marry this man, he's so old, he has white hair, you'll never have a family. But my grandfather was very strong-willed, and she married my grandfather, came to Clovis, worked on the farm side by side with him, and had four children. Their eldest son was my father, Judge Brar. And it's so funny, because when my father was born, they were trying to decide what to name him. And my grandfather's best friend was Judge Burke in Clovis. So instead of naming my father Burke, they named him Judge. So my father's name is Judge.
There's Judge Reinhold and that sort of thing.
So oh,
it's,
good.
It's very cool. It works. I think it's a neat name. Your dad looked like a cool guy, too.
He is very
like
cool.
Jones. He must have had, like, a jacket on.
Yeah, it's so funny.
Yeah. And what did your father do then again?
My father studied marine biology at Fresno State. He went on to become a marine biologist. He was probably the first Indian American marine biologist in America. He worked for the government for a few years, but then when he got married and had me and my brother, he turned to landscape irrigation and farming so that he could support us.
But it all goes back to the land.
It all goes back
to
the land.
So you're going to end up going back to the land, probably. Okay, and then talk to him about becoming a citizen, your grandfather becoming a citizen.
My grandfather became a citizen in 1972, and on that day and afterwards, he never, ever missed an election. Voting was so important to him. So even when he couldn't walk, he had my father take him to the polls so that he could vote. And what my father won't tell you is that my grandfather always voted Democrat, which I love, because my father is a staunch Republican, so this is what I get to throw back in his face, that no, I'm following my grandfather's tradition. He was very proud to be an American. He owned a white Ford all his life. He voted at every election.
Okay, go ahead. He voted it.
My grandfather was very proud of being an American. He owned a white Ford all his life. He voted at every election. When the Caterpillar tractor first came out, it was my grandfather's picture in the advertisement in the newspaper. I don't know what to say now. So you had great pride in being an American.
Because we know he was, so it's more that he loved it and he...
Yes, there was never any talk of going back to India. It was as if his identity as a Sikh and as a Punjabi were allowed to thrive precisely because America was a place that embraced difference. Yeah.
Do the Sikhs have trouble in Punjabi? Are they a minority there? I'm sorry, I don't know.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Let's see.
So there would be reasons not only to come to America to sort of seek your fortune in a different country, but mm-hmm. also because you felt you might be more accepted there than at home?
Sikhs are a minority in India. They're only 2% of India's population. And ever since the founding of the faith in the 15th century, there's been a long history of religious persecution. Sikh history is fraught with battles and martyrdom and sacrifice. Even in the time of the early gurus, there were many battles against the Mughal Empire because a small religious minority had to fight just to survive. And that's where the articles came into play, that Sikhs had these articles of faith so that they would never hide in the face of injustice. And that's what the turban represents, this fierce devotion to justice here now in one's community. When the British came, Sikhs had another chapter of fighting against an empire just to survive. And then, let's see, it's so complicated.
Oh, I'm sure it is. It's just... I mean, I don't know. It's just that I just think that's another important. Oh.
Right. So I can just do this. Okay. Yeah. I know this is loud. It's buzzing. Sorry.
Yeah, I wasn't doing that before.
It's interesting because...
Well, if you don't know if you need that anymore, do you...
Yeah, I
yeah,
think...
Yeah, okay, that's fine.
Let's see.
Oh,
yes.
Well, no, but it wants to...
Oh, I don't know what's doing this. Okay, well, it was Ayatollah Khomeini. That was it, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Let's... Yeah, you'll be fine. You know what you're doing.
I don't know how much... I mean, there's so much I could say about the persecution of Sikhs. In early history and then recent history.
Why would a Sikh have... Because we... Why would Sikhs in general have wanted to come to the United States mm-hmm. from their point of view?
Right.
Be very general.
There's that period of time and there's recently as well. So I should talk about that period of time. Because recently there's been a series of religious persecution in Punjab from 1947 and the partition to 1984 and... the anti-Sikh riots. So that's given rise to a huge wave of immigrants, Sikh immigrants coming from Punjab to find freedom in America. And my grandfather's time, I believe it was, there's two reasons. One was economic and one was religious. I just feel like somebody like Bruce Rebeck is probably much better talking
all
about
right.
this.
Then that's fine.
Because I don't know this for sure.
I just hadn't
yeah.
thought about that, really.
It's a huge...
I mean, I know there's always
yeah.
issues why people come to America. There's always something that makes them leave.
Right.
More than makes them come. But
yeah. In my grandfather's time, I feel that because there were so many brothers, the farming land was being divided more and more into smaller bits. And so the younger sons were encouraged to find life elsewhere in order to really flourish.
Okay. Just wait a second. I want to have you say mm-hmm. that again, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
This thunderstorm all of a sudden or something. Giant jet.
I can imagine there must have been two reasons that motivated my grandfather to immigrate from India to America at that time. One was economic. At that time, the farms in families were being divided into smaller and smaller bits so that the younger sons were encouraged to find their fortune abroad. So my grandfather would have left to find a better economic fortune abroad.
Ah, living in the city, it's...
So my grandfather would have left to find a better economic fortune abroad. But also, I bet there was a political motivation. At that time, India was controlled by the British Empire, and the idea of living one's life in complete freedom in a new land was probably something that really appealed to him. Also, the idea that one can keep their religion and their faith in a new place was something that probably motivated him to seek his dream in America.
No, that's good. Yeah, there was one thing you said before we go on about the Gadar.
The Gadar.
Gadar. Mm-hmm. Okay, Gadar. About what it was, how it was coming. You had a really good description of it, and I think I didn't get it quite properly. And I've been having this nagging feeling that I didn't get it properly.
Okay.
So, would you mind saying that again?
Okay. In the 1920s, my grandfather was a member of the Gadar Party, and the Gadar movement was an organization of Indians outside of India that fought to free India from the British Empire. So they were a group that mobilized to free India from the British. And once the British found out about this organization, there was a huge crackdown and a series of assassinations, and so my grandfather probably at one point had feared for his life because he was part of this movement.
The first bit, so before the airplane mm-hmm. came through. Okay, so you had a funny story about Prohibition. I'm trying to go in chronological order here in my mind.
Yes, during Prohibition, my grandfather had actually learned from his German and Italian friends how to brew wine in his cellar. So he would brew his own wine, and he would invite the mayor and the judge, because they were his good friends, to come over and have wine during Prohibition. So...
it's just funny. I just yeah. like that. It's really funny. So he became an American citizen,
mm-hmm.
and he could you tell me about what you remember about him?
I was 6 years old when my grandfather died, when he was 94 years old. So my early memories, I just remember him sitting in an armchair. At that point, he couldn't walk very much. But when we would visit his house, I would have to hug him, and he had wiry, wiry hair because he had a large beard. So white, wiry hair, and it would be all in my face when I had to give him a kiss and hug him. And then I would sit down and play with my building blocks, and I would hear him talk in the background. And so for so long, my memories of my grandfather centered around these building blocks that I was so excited about. And the day that he died, I remember feeling, I was only... The day that he died, I remember feeling so guilty. I was only 6 years old, but I felt so guilty that I had paid more attention to my building blocks than I did to him. The day that he died, the house was full of people, and I remember turning into the kitchen and seeing my father on the phone calling the funeral home, and it was the first time I had ever seen tears in my father's eyes. And I remember going outside and looking at the sky and just asking God why. I think it was my first experience, my first encounter with death. And I think since then I've been trying to piece back together my grandfather's life, asking everybody I can find who remembered him, what he was like. And all the stories I've received have always warmed me, because he was so respected and so loved, and he believed so much in his children's education that I imagine that he would be really proud of his grandchildren who are at Berkeley and Stanford and Harvard. and I would hope that he would... love the work that we're doing, preserving his history as fundamental to the history of America.
Now, when you were also talking about your personal experience in being a third generation, and how does that feel, and how is that different from the experience of other people who have an Indian background?
Mm-hmm. When I was growing up in Clovis, I never really felt part of the community at school. It was mostly homogeneous, white, conservative Christians, and many of them, when they found out that I was Sikh, tried to pressure me to convert to Christianity. But I couldn't really find solace in my local Gurdwara in the Sikh temple either, because most of the other kids were second generation. Their parents were immigrants. So while they had names like Amardeep and Simranjeet, my name was Valerie. My Punjabi was really poor. Oftentimes they teased me and kind of saw me as whitewashed, as like this hopeless case. So I never really belonged with my friends at school. I was too Sikh at school, and I was too American at the Sikh Gurdwara. So I was in this in-between position as a third-generation Sikh-American girl. And I really think that what formed my identity was my family and my family stories. So the story of my grandfather as a pioneer and his deep, deep roots in America made me proud to be an American, be fully American. And then when my other grandfather would tell me stories about the Sikh religion and what it means to be Sikh and how many people have died to preserve our identity as Sikhs, it made me proud to be Sikh as well. So I feel... There's an old saying that goes, what the son forgets, the grandson remembers. And I think in my case, it's what the son forgets, the granddaughter remembers. I feel like so much of my work right now, my projects and my academic work, focuses on what it means to be an American and what it means to have such vibrant and colorful roots in a different religion, in a different culture, in a different country, and yet have that identity fully flourish in America alongside other distinct identities.
That's wonderful. I kind of want to ask you about, you've said what your grandfather means, but what's your grandfather as an immigrant wanting to come on his own and creating his own life here, what can he mean for everybody? Like, is there something that, sort of like, why is his story, because it is wonderful, and it's an amazing story, and it's great that he was there, and that he, you know, was part of this community of different people. Is there something more that we can take from him?
I imagine my grandfather leaving his home village when he was 17 and arriving...
That's what I hear.
I imagine my grandfather leaving his home village when he was 17 and taking a steamship all the way to the shores of California in 1913 when he was only 20. And I imagine what that must have been like. It must have been like going to the moon or a different planet to take such a long journey and walk so fearlessly into the unknown. And I think that ideal of crossing the deepest of one's fears in search of a dream is something that has really resonated with me. And it's something that I always remember every time I'm faced with something that paralyzes me with fear. An example is September 11th and what happened at that point. On that day, like everybody else, I was completely paralyzed with fear. And when a man from our community, a Sikh man, was killed as a first person killed in a post 9/11 hate crime, my fear turned into confusion and absolute paralysis. And I had a choice. I could either stay paralyzed in that fear and stay in my bedroom and stay in my home where it was safe and everything was known, or I could cross over that fear in order to find out why. So, with my grandfather's ideal in my mind, I got in the car with my cousin and drove across the country for 4 months and gathered interviews with Sikh, Muslim, Arab Americans about their encounters on the streets of America in the aftermath of September 11th. And I was only 20. So...
Can you say I was only 20?
Mm-hmm. I was only 20 years old. So in an effort to follow my grandfather's footsteps when he was 20 to do something that was completely fearful in pursuit of a larger vision. I think that's something that I tried to embody when I started making this documentary in the aftermath of 9/11.
Okay, so let's have you introduce yourself again. Could you say I am and say your name again, and then tell me what you're doing, what the documentary is, and as if it's done, and everyone who's listening can go see it right now.
I am Valerie Kaur. In the aftermath of September 11th, I was 20 years old. I am a Sikh American, and I took my camera across the country for 4 months, and I gathered interviews with Sikh, Muslim, Arab, South Asian, all kinds of Americans to find out what it means to be America. let me say that again.
Sure. That's what we all need to know. We're all working towards that right now.
I am Valerie Kaur. In the aftermath of September 11th, I was 20 years old. I'm a Sikh American, and I took my camera across the country for 4 months to gather interviews with all kinds of Americans, Sikhs, Muslims, Arabs, Japanese Americans, white Americans, scholars, lawyers, legislators, to find out what it means to be American. The documentary, Divided We Fall, is an exploration of hate, violence, and hope in the aftermath of September 11th. It focuses on the stories of violence and the hate epidemic that consumed the country after 9/11 to find out what it means to be American. Who are we as Americans? What does an American look like? Who is America? Who do we want to be? I need to think of a better soundbite for the film, but...
So then what is this film going to accomplish? What would you like this film to accomplish?
Let me think for a second.
Okay.
A couple things I could say. Hang on. The film takes you on a journey across America into and out of the lives of hundreds of people. My goal is when people hear these stories, see these faces, hear their voices, my goal is for them to turn to each other and to share their stories with each other. There is true redemption in storytelling. Stories can bind us, can break us open, can make us human to each other. And the idea that the problem of hate in America is not going to be solved entirely by legislation on the top level. The way it's going to change is by social transformation on the ground level, here and now, in the space between us. And so if we can turn to each other and ask each other who we are, where we came from, who do we want to be, where do we want to go, that would be the ultimate vision for this film. I'm so sorry. I really need to think of better.
It's fine. Who's been... you've been doing this, and you brought together other people. Who's backing you on this, or is it pretty much just your own pocket? And I don't mean money necessarily, but, you know, what kind of people are helping you with this project?
The film began as a student project 4 years ago. Fast forward 4 years, and it's grown into a feature-length independent documentary film. We've been supported by Panavision and Kodak, and then grassroots support from the people who've had the least to give in our communities. They've given the most to have these stories appear on the big screen. Other than that, it's been mostly self-funded as well. I'm working with an award-winning director, Sharath Raju, and his production team. So we're marrying the stories that I gathered with his expertise as a filmmaker and his vision to bring you Divided We Fall.
Okay. Let me see. I always get proud at how far I can go before I have to look at my questions. I'm sure I've asked you all the questions. So the first time, sorry, going back to your grandfather, the first time, what port did he go to, and the second time, what port did he go to?
I believe they were both San Francisco.
Okay, so he came to San Francisco, he had to pay a port fee.
Yes, but...
Do you mind saying that a little more explicitly, when they initially came? And...
My grandfather arrived with his older brother, Dal Singh, in San Francisco in 1913, but the port authorities demanded a $5 port fee. My suspicion is that there were great racial tensions at that time on the western coast of America, and once they took a look at the passengers on the ship, they immediately made sure that they wouldn't enter unless they had this exorbitant fee. $5 isn't that much to us now, but it was a lot back then. So they turned my grandfather and his brother away, and they returned all the way back to Manila, where they worked for a few more months to gather the money. And then they returned to San Francisco in September 1913 in order to pay the fee and enter the country as Americans.
Did they know Spanish as well?
No, my grandfather spoke very little English, and over the decades, he learned more and more English in order to converse.
Okay.
But he had an elementary school education.
So he didn't, I was going to ask if he had a British accent, but he didn't really learn English while he was in.
No, you have to remember that the first wave of immigrants in those days were mostly farmers and laborers. It was only until the 1960s where your doctors and engineers come from India. But in those days, they were largely uneducated, largely illiterate, really leaving everything they had to find a new life elsewhere. And they really found it here in America.
So, they went down the coast and went to the trade. So, were there any other ways besides his turban and his beard that he would be distinguished? Would he have eaten food differently? Would he have acted differently than his peers? Or would... I mean, I know the turban is... part of the reason is to make yourself distinguished.
He would have eaten Punjabi food, so the rotis and the dals, the lentils, the sabjis, the vegetable concoctions with all the spices. Those are distinctly Punjabi, and I know that his older brother was a great cook, so he cooked for both of them all those years until my grandfather got married. But it's funny because a lot of his peers who married Mexican wives really tried hard to teach the Mexican wives how to make Punjabi dishes. And so there would be this fusion of Mexican-Punjabi dishes, which reflected this fusion of cultures that those families embodied. But in my grandfather, it would have eaten this distinct food, would have kept his turban and his beard, would have conversed in Punjabi with fellow Punjabi laborers. But
were there many, do you think?
I know that up until 1915, I believe there were 6,000 Punjabi laborers in California. I have to check that number.
But he had other people.
Yes, yes. And it was, you know, decades later when my grandmother came, my grandfather and my grandmother were responsible for bringing over many other Indians to California. And when they first arrived, they would stay with my grandfather before they started their own life.
Were these people from his community that he was from?
Mm-hmm.
So from, he kept contact with?
Yes, he would send money back home. In fact, if you go back to Punjab and go back to his home village, Chandnama, there is a memorial that my grandfather built for his older brother, Dal Singh. And it's on the same piece of land that, you know, my grandfather's family had owned. So when I go back to that village and I visit this memorial, I always see all these children who have come to see their American cousin who's returned to pay a visit to her grandfather's memory.
So you've been back?
Yes, yes, I have.
So how many cousins? Well, he left a large family, did you say? Or I think you said that.
I think he was one of four brothers. Mm-hmm. And so the other brothers who are still in Punjab, their families are still in the small village of Chandnama. So when we go back to India, when we go back to the village, we can meet the descendants of his brothers and be reconnected with our Punjabi second cousins.
What do they think of him? Is it kind of like, ooh, he was the one who did something wild? Or...
I think there's a great deal of admiration and respect. And there is a great appreciation as well, because my grandfather would send back money to support the village and the families.
Mm-hmm. one thing you were talking about was the tolerance that your grandfather had and why he might have had tolerance. And could you make a comparison, perhaps, with that and with what might be going on today?
I think of Clovis in those early days, and I think of a small community, a farming town, made up of many immigrant families where everybody knew everybody else. You took care of your neighbor because if your neighbor was doing well, you were doing well. It was a community where people knew each other. Everyone I've run into from those days talks with great respect about my grandfather, and they talk about him in their lives and at the store, or at the bank, or in these public spaces where people would often meet and gather and get to know each other and support each other. I think of Clovis now, and I think of this farming town turned into suburbs and strip malls, and organized in such a way where people don't know each other anymore. They don't know their neighbors anymore as well as they used to. And so when you don't know a person face to face, there's much more opportunity to make judgments about others and for stereotypes to flourish and for fear to flourish. And I think post September 11th, you've really seen that, where even in a place like Clovis, where such respect and community once existed, there's enough misunderstanding and distance from each other that there's a lot of fear and there's hate that comes up in different ways.
So just one more thing, and then I'll ask you if you have anything else to add. So mm-hmm. what can we do? Make things better.
Let me think. Wait 1 second. Let me think. When I was on the road in the aftermath of September 11th, I heard story after story of violence and hate and intolerance. When I went to India, I looked for the widow of Balbir Singh Sodhi, the first man who was killed in the aftermath of September 11th. She was my last interviewee. And when I met her, she was dressed in white, and there were dark circles under her eyes. Even the mention of her husband's name would make her cry. I had only one question for her. What would you like to tell the people of America? I was expecting bitterness. I was expecting anger or resentment, because it was what I was beginning to feel after hearing all these stories. And she looked at me and she said, "Thank you. Tell them thank you."
Can you say that again? I'm sorry.
when she looked at me. But this is what she said. She looked at me and she told me, "Tell them thank you. When I came to America for my husband's funeral, they came out in the thousands, and they cried with me, and they cared for me. Tell them thank you for caring." It was at that moment that I realized that there are very few people whose faces are so hardened by hate that they can't be transformed by our stories. The Phoenix community came out in the thousands because they heard Balbir Singh Sodhi's story. They saw his face in the local news. They learned that he came to America from India to escape religious persecution. They understood that he would never see his American grandchildren. They understood that his widow's heart was now broken. These are human things. They are human things that bind us together. And because his story was told, they came out and stood side by side with his widow, they had never met before. This gives me hope. It makes me think that no matter how much violence has taken place...
Can you start with this gives me hope? Before I lose it, too. Okay. Just you.
Okay.
So go ahead and try.
Okay. This widow, who had lost more than anyone else, gave me hope. The fact that she could find hope in the solidarity she experienced with other Americans made me realize that no matter how much violence takes place, there are always opportunities to turn to each other, to tell each other our stories, to cry with each other, to stand with each other in solidarity and in strength. In doing this, I believe we reclaim what is so great about America, that it's a place of true freedom and true community, that in all of our differences, we can still be one human community. I think of my grandfather and his choice of building his life in this new land of America. And I think of Babir Singh Sodhi's widow and her persistence in believing in the American dream. And this gives me hope that I can do my work here in this country and join with others to turn this country away from fear, away from hate, away from violence, and towards strength and solidarity and hope, reclaiming the American dream.
Is there anything else you want to tell me or any other stories you remember?
Oh, there's so many. I feel like I could do a better job with the film. I hadn't prepared my soundbite yet of what the film ought to be. Divided We Fall is a documentary film that follows my journey across the country in the aftermath of September 11th. We go into and out of people's lives, Sikh, Muslim, Arab, lawyers, legislators, scholars, all kinds of Americans asking the same question: what does it mean to be American? In the end, I find the heart of America halfway around the world, in a small village in India, at the doorstep of a widow. Come and watch the film to find out what she says. Even though I just told you, but... Terrible. I need to think of a better way to do this.
That's okay.
My grandfather's stories are included in a film that I'm making called Divided We Fall. It's a feature-length documentary film that explores hate, violence, and hope in the aftermath of September 11th. In pursuing the question, who are we as Americans, I went back into...
You're saying pursuing the question, mm-hmm.
In pursuing the question, who are we? In my journey across the country, I pursued the question, who are we as Americans? And in doing so, I realized that so many of the answers to that question was found in my own family history and my grandfather's own life. In the 1970s, during the Iran hostage crisis, the picture of the Ayatollah Khomeini was shown on the news every single night.
Wait a second.
Mm-hmm. Should I say it again? Mm-hmm.
Must be in the flight path of something.
I know. It's Burbank Airport is nearby. Maybe that's it. I never realized how loud this room is.
I know. You don't. You have to record it.
In the 1970s, during the Iran hostage crisis, the picture of the Ayatollah Khomeini with a beard and turban was on the news every single night. At that time, my grandfather was very old. He was riding in a car with my father, and my father told me... At that time, my grandfather was very old. He had a beard, a white beard, and a turban. He was stopped at a stoplight with my father when a group of boys in the car next to him started yelling all of these profanities and making all these lewd gestures. My father tells me that my grandfather didn't notice. He was sitting quietly, but my father noticed, and it broke his heart. And he told me that my grandfather was probably more American than those kids. And I think of the waves of discrimination that have appeared in our country even before 9/11, and how my grandfather had to experience that. Oh gosh, I don't even know where I'm going.
It's okay.
I wonder where I should, how I should end it.
Maybe, I mean, even as the laws continue to allow more people to own land and more people to become citizens.
Yeah, okay.
There were still issues making him more of a target than he had been in the past.
Yes.
Which is sort of odd.
Yes. Even
but
as...
now there's a big ring in this area somewhere.
I don't know what that is.
It's really a piece about airplanes that we're doing. And
yes. He flew to America.
On a steam plane.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Even after the laws that barred my grandfather from owning land, from becoming a citizen, became lifted. Even as the laws that kept my grandfather from becoming a citizen and from owning land were lifted in the 1940s, there have still been moments in our history, in American history, that have made my grandfather and people in my community targets of hate and violence. In the 1970s, during the Iran hostage crisis, my grandfather was yelled at by a group of boys who saw him and registered his face as associated with the Ayatollah Khomeini. And even now, after 9/11, the face of bin Laden flashing over and over again between the towers falling over and over again propped up the face of the enemy in American national consciousness, so that the enemy, the un-American, the non-citizen, the less than human, looked this way. And anybody who looks this way deserves our violence, deserves our vengeance. And as a result, thousands of Americans in the aftermath of September 11th have been targets of discrimination, of intolerance. They've been seen as laughable, as not American, as less than human. And I think the goal, I think laws only get us so far. I think what is required is a change in the culture itself to expand the circle of who looks like an American to include all Americans, so that people with Japanese faces, Chinese faces, Sikhs, Muslims are seen not as foreigners, not as perpetual foreigners, not as enemies to America, but part of the very American fabric. And the fact that my grandfather has been part of American history since the 1900s makes me believe that only if we can get these stories out to Americans to make them see how diverse the picture of an American really is, only then can we create a community of true respect and solidarity and strength.